if you think just for a minute, the principal heritage in Canada, certainly the one that owns the country, is mm-hmm. Anglican. And it's Anglican from particular parts of Britain, not the same parts as the mass settlement of the United States. I mean, the United States was settled by the dissenting population of Britain, the Congregationalists and the Presbyterians. But the Anglicans, or the State Church of England, is the principal influence on the culture of Canada. So there are huge differences between those theologies, but let me call them philosophies, since most people are unaware of the theological roots of this. The school had to cancel out the dissenting mind that was coming from Britain. It had to cancel that out by training children in habits of obedience. Not obedience to their parents, not obedience to their religion, not obedience to their traditions, but obedience to strangers hired by the political state. And once again, we're talking about Major League radical here.
Scary.
Really is scary, because the ultimate purpose, once Darwin checked onto the British scene in the middle of the 19th century, the key was in hand to justify what was underway. Prior to Darwin's Origin of Species in 1859 and his Descent of Man in 1871, prior to that time, you had to justify elites and differential behavior by religion. The Anglican Church teaches in its homily of obedience that God has ordained all these different levels of society, and that to want to get out of your particular position is sacrilegious. That's a pretty good straitjacket. But it was also protected by the police power of the state. You could use superior wealth to hire police who would subordinate, and then you would own the means of making a living, and you would only pass those out to people who were docile. So, but the United States didn't have that for a long time, except in the British-controlled coastal parts of the East. Over the course of a couple of hundred years, what grew up, and the same thing was true, of course, in Western Canada for a long time. I mean, prior to the telegraph and roads and cars and things, to actually reach out and fine-tune the life of communities was just impossible, except right near the large population bases. Mm-hmm. So quite a respectable, let me call it a libertarian population, occurred in both countries there. But gradually, with the rise of technology, easy transport, etc., that those libertarian elements were more and more marginalized. And then along comes Darwin. And what he teaches specifically, it's not an accident that Darwinism is probably the single great scientific truth, in quotation marks, truth, taught by schools. And it's taught in every school in Canada and the United States, not because there's a massive scientific proof that it took place. There isn't. But because, as part and parcel of the universal theory of evolution, I'm not arguing against the theory of evolution here. I'm telling you what its social and political ramifications are. Darwin said quite explicitly that not everyone was evolving. In fact, only a tiny fraction of the population was evolving, about 5%. The other 95%, 19 people out of 20, were evolutionary dead ends. And in his second big book, Descent of Man, he spells out what will happen if you allow the good breeding stock, the 5%, to intermarry with the bad breeding stock, the 95%. He said plain and simple that evolution would march backwards into the swirling mists of the dawnless past. Now, suppose for just a moment that you were a wealthy drawing room lady, or I was a wealthy drawing room husband, And we were chatting about these exciting ideas coming out of England, and suddenly we realized that almost everyone around us outside the sanctity of that drawing room was a dead end, making eyes at our daughters and sons, right? Mm-hmm. Ready to send the human race back into the swamp. That the amusing thing is that responsible people who bought into those ideas, and you couldn't very well not buy into them, just as today you can't very well not buy into them without identifying yourself as some kind of nut. As soon as you accept that, it's part of your responsibility as a superior citizen to build safeguards into the society to make sure that the bad stuff doesn't mess it up for the good stuff. How are you going to do that? Well, you can't do it for very long with your army and your police force, because basically your army and your police force are all bad stuff. Now, you can use them like a spot cleaner and on a fabric, some stains on it. But what you can't do is extend a nonstop police pressure on the population. You have to do what John Calvin taught the English in Institutes of the Christian Religion had to be done to get the damned to police themselves. Calvin was writing in 1635, you know, 370 years ago, 369. And he said these people have to be set against one another to police one another and to keep them out of the hair of the elect. Well, now, the theory of evolution is a secular theory, or so it appears on the surface. It's actually a different form of religious speculation. It says that a small fraction are elected biologically, and the rest are damned and dangerous. So how do you protect the good stuff from the bad stuff? Well, first you take the children away from the bad stuff, and you drill the children in forms of separation, of competition. You teach them not to trust one another. You teach them that they're in a deadly competition for livings in a very short time, that there's a huge dossier of numbers being accumulated, you know, that will dictate their entire future. It's all horse manure, but it's true if you believe it's true. It's just fascinating. I mean, there are, look, one out of every five wealthy people in Canada and the United States, one in every five is strictly working class. They manage to preserve the traditions that once you learn to do something that a lot of people wanted done, you could broker a service that delivered those kind of workers, and you could get just as rich as somebody who was the chief surgeon or the head stockbroker. That's true today, but you won't hear that in any school in the United States or in Canada.
We'll be right back. hooking up again. Yo, mama, silly ass bitch.
Come on, I mean, man, we can talk about this.
Oh, come on, I'm a girl, and I'll still kick your ass.
You are listening to Radio Free School on CFMU.
I looked for, a dozen years into the intimate details of colonial life over here in the Americas. And the minute you do that, there's abundant detailed evidence of the different way that young people were reared and the ability of these young people given back their minds to make radical successes, to be extremely effective in the political life of the community. You know, take the American Revolution, for instance. Virtually everybody who made the American Revolution was a teenager there. Now, Washington was the grand old man. I think he was 42 there, but Jefferson and Hamilton and really the whole pack of them were 17, 18, 19, 20, 21.
Wow.
They had been, you know, the boot and the myths that keep us small and in our place had temporarily been blown away, and they were able to overthrow the most powerful military nation on earth, huh?
Mm-hmm.
With, you know, barefoot people. It's, well.
Well, that kind of leads me to ask you, I mean, I don't know if you want to continue that, but I wanted to know what does it mean to be an educated person?
Well, isn't it ironic that question is virtually never asked? Where am I likeliest to find a concentration of educated young people that I can study and see what their goals are and what the goals of their coaches are? And then it dawned on me that the elite private boarding schools, the ones that carry on the tradition of Westminster and Eton and Harrow, there are about half a dozen over there. The ones here that carried on that tradition would absolutely be aiming to produce an educated managerial class to manage the rest of us dopes. So I began to study there are about 20 of them in the United States. I mean, there are hundreds and hundreds that claim to be, but there are about 20 that produce streams of powerful managers. Take the upcoming American presidential election. The challenger is from St. Paul's, which is 1, 2, 3 of the most prestigious boarding schools in the United States. And the incumbent president is from Andover. That's one of the top 10. If you go back to the last election, we have the incumbent president being elected, and we have his main competition being from St. Albans in Washington, Al Gore. That's certainly on everybody's top 15 list there. We also have John McCain, who represents himself as a man of the people, but in fact went to Episcopal, which is on everybody's top 5 list. Or we have Steve Forbes, who went to Kent, which was underwritten by J.P. Morgan. I mean, we're talking here about a populace that has been so numbed intellectually that it's incapable of responding to evidence that's right under its nose. You don't have to be a conspiracy theorist to say that in a nation of 300 million people, the United States, if two fraternity brothers from the same fraternity chapter at the same college in the same years were the opponents in the presidential election, that something awfully fishy was going on. And that yet is the case in the current presidential election. What's most exciting and depressing to me is that the press refuses to enlighten the public about the implications of that in a so-called democracy.